Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If he's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. We're sorry that we had to cut off the last program. It was put on the air a couple minutes too late, and it was going to throw the rest of the morning off. The Old Mole is a political magazine for the radio. We bring you interviews, reviews, commentary, analysis, music, history from a radical socialist feminist point of view. To start off today's show, we're going to do something a little different. Bill Resnick's going to introduce a few installments of documentary narrator Sharon Grant dramatically reading excerpts from Nicole Hannah-Jones' essay, "Our Democracy's Founding Ideals Were False When They Were Written, Black Americans Have Fought to Make Them True." Published by the New York Times as part of their 1619 project, the essay addresses black contributions to liberty, justice, and democracy in U.S. history. Larry Bolden reviews Kylie Reed's debut novel, Such a Fun Age, praised by critics for its gripping portrayal of intersecting class and racialized realities. We are looking forward to hear this Bookmole review. As some of you may know, I've played the banjo for most of the time that I've done the Old Mole these last 10 years. When I first learned how to play, I was introduced to the playing style called clawhammer, or frailing, which is associated with old-time music and distinctly different from the finger-picking styles common in bluegrass. Instead of picking upward from the underside of the nails, the right hand forms a kind of claw that strokes down on the strings with the main part of the fingernail, while the thumb rhythmically pulls off the short fifth string. I found this much more intuitive when I learned it from others. Later, I learned from a library book, Karen Lynn's That Half-Barbaric Twang, The Banjo in American Popular Culture, that the clawhammer style is a living tradition of banjo playing that goes back to how enslaved Africans played hundreds of years ago. Steeped in sounds and images of white supremacist blackface minstrelsy for over a century, it surprises many to this day to learn that the banjo originated in cultures of resistance and resilience during the Atlantic slave trade. So throughout today's show, we're going to hear selections of banjo music and documentaries I've found about the Afro-Atlantic roots and significance of the banjo. You can listen to today's show and archives of our past shows when it's posted in a day or two by going to kboo.fm/oldmole. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter by looking for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and email us with comments, questions, or your interest in participating at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Now, we turn to Bill Resnick and Sharon Grant.
Hi, folks. Recently, I began looking for writing on black history and the black experience in the United States of North America. I was looking for writing that vividly did two things. First, to examine the persistence of racism and how it was manifested for the last 400 years. And second, to examine continued black struggle and vividly and accessibly show how important it was, not just in making black gains, but also in shaping this country, the best of this country, in fact, to make it more free, just, democratic, and culturally rich. Of course, with a long way to go towards justice and democracy. I was looking for one writer. I found a group of writers, a group of black journalists, most from the New York Times, who used the tremendous volume of literature, including slave narratives, personal and family histories, academic work by historians. And they produced what amounts to a short book. It filled the whole issue of the New York Times Sunday Magazine. It was led by a woman, Nicole Hannah-Jones, who wrote a number of the sections and one wonderful essay. You'll hear excerpts from that essay today. Its title is, "Our Democracy's Founding Ideals Were False When They Were Written. Black Americans Have Fought to Make Them True." So I tried to get an interview with her, but she's enormously in demand with Pulitzer and MacArthur Prizes. So today I'm joined by Sharon Grant, an African-American woman from Brooklyn and Chicago, and has strangely enough lived in Portland longer than either of those places. She's been a community health worker and health educator for Multnomah County for over 20 years. She has a great voice, has sung a lot, done pro bono publico, voiceovers for videos, and we're going to bring Nicole Hannah-Jones's essay to you. So, hello, Sharon Grant. Welcome to KABU.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me. I hope this program encourages listeners to read the New York Times Magazine article you mentioned. It's called 1619, and it can be found at nytimes.com/1619, and aims to show a more accurate history of America. And the 1619 Project comes out of that work that they did.
So, Sharon, let's begin.
Okay. My dad always flew an American flag in our front yard. The blue paint on our two-story house was perennially chipping. The fence, or the rail by the stairs, or the front door existed in a perpetual state of disrepair. But that flag always flew pristine. Our corner lot, which had been redlined by the federal government, was along the river that divided the black side from the white side of our Iowa town. At the edge of our lawn, high on an aluminum pole, soared the flag, which my dad would replace as soon as it showed the slightest tatter. My dad was born into a family of sharecroppers on a white plantation in Greenwood, Mississippi, where black people bent over cotton from can't see in the morning to can't see at night, just as their enslaved ancestors had done not long before. The Mississippi of my dad's youth was an apartheid state that subjugated its near-majority black population through breathtaking acts of violence. White residents in Mississippi lynched more black people than those in any other state in the country, and the white people in my dad's home county lynched more black residents than those in any other county in Mississippi, often for such crimes as entering a room occupied by white women, bumping into a white girl, or trying to start a sharecropper's union. My dad's mother, like all the black people in Greenwood, could not vote, use the public library, or find work other than toiling in the cotton fields or toiling in white people's houses. So in the 1940s, she packed up her few belongings and her three small children and joined the flood of black Southerners fleeing north. She got off the Illinois Central Railroad in Waterloo, Iowa, only to have her hopes of the mythical promised land shattered when she learned that Jim Crow did not end at the Mason-Dixon line. Grandmama, as we called her, found a house in a segregated black neighborhood on the city's east side and then found the work that was considered black women's work no matter where black women lived, cleaning white people's houses. Dad, too, struggled to find promise in this land. In 1962, at age 17, he signed up for the Army. Like many young men, he joined in hopes of escaping poverty, but he went into the military for another reason as well, a reason common to black men. Dad hoped that if he served his country might finally treat him as an American. The Army did not end up being his way out. He was passed over for opportunities, his ambition stunted. He would be discharged under murky circumstances and then labor in a series of service jobs for the rest of his life. Like all the black men and women in my family, he believed in hard work, but like all the black men and women in my family, no matter how hard he worked, he never got ahead. So when I was young, that flag outside our home never made sense to me. How could this black man, having seen firsthand the way his country abused black Americans, how it refused to treat us as full citizens, proudly fly this banner? I didn't understand his patriotism. It deeply embarrassed me. I had been taught in school, through cultural osmosis, that the flag wasn't really ours, that our history as a people began with enslavement, and that we had contributed little to this great nation. It seemed that the closest thing black Americans could have to cultural pride was to be found in our vague connection to Africa, a place we had never been. That my dad felt so much honor in being an American felt like a marker of his degradation, his acceptance of our subordination. Like most young people, I thought I understood so much when in fact I understood so little. My father knew exactly what he was doing when he raised that flag. He knew that our people's contributions to building the richest and most powerful nation in the world were indelible, that the United States simply would not exist without us. Before the abolishment of the international slave trade, 400,000 enslaved Africans would be sold into America. Those individuals and their descendants transformed the lands to which they'd been brought into some of the most successful colonies in the British Empire. Through back-breaking labor, they cleared the land across the southeast. They taught the colonists to grow rice. They grew and picked the cotton that at the height of the slavery was the nation's most valuable commodity, accounting for half of all American exports and 66% of the world's supply. They built the plantations of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison, sprawling properties that today attract thousands of visitors from across the globe, captivated by the history of the world's greatest democracy. They laid the foundations of the White House and the Capitol, even placing with their unfree hands the Statue of Freedom atop the Capitol Dome. They lugged the heavy wooden tracks of the railroads that crisscrossed the South and that helped take the cotton they picked to the northern textile mills, fueling the Industrial Revolution. They built vast fortunes for white people north and south. At one time, the second richest man in the nation was a Rhode Island slave trader. Profits from black people's stolen labor helped the young nation pay off its war debts and financed some of our most prestigious universities. It was the relentless buying, selling, insuring, and financing of their bodies and the products of their labor that made Wall Street a thriving banking, insurance, and trading sector, and New York City the financial capital of the world. But it would be historically inaccurate to reduce the contributions of black people to the vast material wealth created by our bondage. Black Americans have also been, and continue to be, foundational to the idea of American freedom. More than any other group in this country's history, we have served, generation after generation, in an overlooked but vital role. It is we who have been the perfecters of this democracy.
The vast limitations of U.S. democracy, actually in many ways a democracy for the few, is discussed later in the project. The project, again, is titled 1619, the year the first slaves were brought to this country and promptly sold for good money to the pirates, who had themselves stolen them from a Portuguese slave trading ship. This 20-some were the first of many millions brought to the Americas. The essay, whose introduction was read by Sharon Gratt, is part of a New York Times, credit to them, actually. It's part of a series that will become a book and continuously growing website called 1619. The next section of this essay is about the nation's hypocrisy, but it begins with Nicole Hannah-Jones' overall view of the black contribution to this country's always resisted and still imperfect, to say the least, political and social democracy. Indeed, each democratic turn fought for from below was followed by elite machinations, also at least with some success, machinations to regain dominance.
The United States is a nation founded on both an ideal and a lie. Our Declaration of Independence, approved on July 4, 1776, proclaims that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. But the white men who drafted those words did not believe them to be true for the hundreds of thousands of black people in their midst. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness did not apply to fully one-fifth of the country. Yet despite being violently denied the freedom and justice promised to all, black Americans believed fervently in the American creed. Through centuries of black resistance and protest, we have helped the country live up to its founding ideals. And not only for ourselves, black rights struggles paved the way for every other rights struggle, including women's and gay rights, immigrant and disability rights. Without the idealistic, strenuous, and patriotic efforts of black Americans, our democracy today would most likely look very different. it might not be a democracy at all.
We have a wall through the shadows of death. We had to walk all by ourselves, but we'll never turn back until we have all been free. Until we have all been freed.
That was Mavis Staples, We'll Never Turn Back. And this is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour with Sharon Grant. She's presenting excerpts, a greeting from an essay by Nicole Hannah-Jones on Black struggle and its immense contributions to the shaping of this country. Sharon Grant, in the next section, Nicole Hannah-Jones discussed the never-resolved contradictions of two of this country's most revered figures. Thomas Jefferson and the Founding Fathers, as history calls them, were revered for their democratic ideals and commitments. But whereas Nicole Hannah-Jones and many scholars have shown, they were deeply infected by racist ideas. This, of course, has continued to the present, as has the fight back against white patriarchal rule, and always led by black struggle, that from the Civil War amendments to the Constitution and the civil rights legislation of the 1960s.
In June 1776, Thomas Jefferson sat at his portable writing desk in a rented room in Philadelphia and penned these words: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." For the last 243 years, this fierce assertion of the fundamental and natural rights of humankind to freedom and self-governance has defined our global reputation as a land of liberty. As Jefferson composed his expiring words, however, a teenage boy who would enjoy none of those rights and liberties waited nearby to serve at his master's beck and call. His name was Robert Hemings, and he was the half-brother of Jefferson's wife, born to Martha Jefferson's father and a woman he owned. It was common for white enslavers to keep their half-black children in slavery. Jefferson had chosen Hemings from among about 130 enslaved people that worked on the forced labor camp he called Monticello to accompany him to Philadelphia and ensure his every comfort as he drafted the text making the case for a new democratic republic based on the individual rights of men. At the time, one-fifth of the population within the 13 colonies struggled under a brutal system of slavery unlike anything that had existed in the world before. Chattel slavery was not conditional, but racial. It was heritable and permanent, not temporary, meaning generations of black people were born into it and passed their enslaved status onto their children. Enslaved people were not recognized as human beings, but as property that could be mortgaged, traded, bought, sold, used as collateral, given as a gift, and disposed of violently. Jefferson's white colonists knew that black people were human beings, but they created a network of laws and customs, astounding for both their precision and cruelty, that ensured that enslaved people would never be treated as such. As the abolitionist William Goodell wrote in 1853, quote, "If anything founded on falsehood might be called a science, we might add the system of American slavery to the list of strict sciences," unquote. Jefferson and the other founders were keenly aware of this hypocrisy. And so in Jefferson's original draft of the Declaration of Independence, he tried to argue that it wasn't the colonists' fault. Instead, he blamed the King of England for forcing the institution of slavery on the unwilling colonists and called the tracking in human beings a crime. Yet neither Jefferson nor most of the founders intended to abolish slavery, and in the end, they struck that passage out. There is no mention of slavery in the final Declaration of Independence. Similarly, 11 years later, when it came time to draft the Constitution, the framers carefully constructed a document that preserved and protected slavery without ever using the word. In the texts in which they were making the case for freedom to the world, they did not want to explicitly enshrine their hypocrisy, so they sought to hide it. The Constitution contains 84 clauses. 6 deal directly with slavery, as the historian David Wallstriker has written, and 5 more hold implications for slavery. The Constitution protected the property of those who enslaved black people, prohibited the federal government from intervening to end the importation of enslaved Africans for a term of 20 years, allowed Congress to mobilize militia to put down insurrections by the enslaved, and forced states that had outlawed slavery to turn over enslaved people who had run away seeking refuge. Like many others, the writer and abolitionist Samuel Bryan called out the deceit, saying of the Constitution, quote, "The words are dark and ambiguous, such as no plain man of common sense would have used, and are evidently chosen to conceal from Europe that in this enlightened country, the practice of slavery has its advocates among men in the highest stations," unquote. The Supreme Court enshrined this thinking in the law in its 1857 Dred Scott decision, ruling that black people, whether enslaved or free, came from a slave race. This made them inferior to white people and therefore incompatible with American democracy. Democracy was for citizens, and the Negro race, the court ruled, was, quote, "a separate class of persons," unquote, which the founders had, quote, "not regarded as a portion of the people or citizens of the government and had no rights which white man was bound to respect," unquote. This belief that black people were not merely enslaved but were a slave race became the root of the endemic racism that we still cannot purge from this nation to this day. If black people could not ever be citizens, if they were a caste apart from all other humans, then they did not require the rights bestowed by the Constitution, and so the "we" in "we the people" was a lie.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host. With Bill Resnick playing a support role, that was Sharon Grant reading excerpts from an essay by Nicole Hannah-Jones titled, "Our Democracy's Founding Ideals Were False When They Were Written. Black Americans Have Fought to Make Them True." On next week's Old Mole, Sharon Grant will read more excerpts from the second half of that essay. They'll include reflections on smashed hopes of integration after black Americans returned from World War II, continuing black struggles generating the civil rights movement, which changed this country with considerable benefits for women, the disabled, and sexual minorities, but not as much to this day for blacks themselves. Up next, we're going to hear Rhiannon Giddens and a song she performed for the PBS show David Holt's State of Music, titled Julie, sung to the tune of an English murder ballad, Pretty Polly. After that, we're going to hear a short art history analysis of the Henry Ossawa Taylor masterpiece, The Banjo Lesson, one of the most famous paintings of the banjo. And later on in the show, we'll hear more from Rhiannon Giddens playing banjo and talking about the history of the instrument among enslaved Africans and their descendants.
See down yonder the soldiers have come. Julie, oh Julie, can't you see that them devils have come to take you far from me? Mistress, oh mistress, I won't run, 'cause I see down yonder the soldiers have come. Mistress, oh mistress, I do see, and I'll stay right here till they come for me. Us who love you and all you hold dear. Mistress, oh mistress, I will go. Leave this house and all I know. Mistress, oh mistress, I will leave here. With what family I got left, they're all I hold dear. That trunk of gold is yours, my friend. Mistress, oh mistress, I won't lie. If they find that trunk of gold by your side, mistress, oh mistress, that trunk of gold is what you got when my children you sold. Staying here is too high. Mistress, oh mistress, I wish you well. But in leaving here, I'm leaving hell.
Today's Black History Moment, we're going to examine the Banjo Lesson by Henry Ossawa Taylor. He was the first African-American artist to receive international attention for his work. In 1893, on a short return visit to the United States, Henry Ossawa Taylor painted his most famous work, The Banjo Lesson, while in his native Philadelphia. Taylor's desire to show us his vision of resilience, spiritual grace, and creative and intellectual promise of post-Civil War African-Americans is fully realized. The scene is staged in the small confines of a log cabin, a hearth fire casting light from the right corner, and a natural white glow from outside enters from the left. The boy holds the banjo in both hands, his downward gaze a reflection of his focus and concentration on his grandfather's instruction. The older man holds the banjo up gently with his left hand, so that the boy is not encumbered by its weight. Yet the staging shows us that the man wants the boy to come into his own realization of music and its rewards. The boy is bathed in the glow of the fire's warmth while a glimmer of white light shining across his forehead, the center of knowledge and understanding. The older man is submerged in the cool shadows of the room. This carefully orchestrated play of warmth and cool, of shadow and light, conveys the success of future generations is built upon the legacy of the previous ones. The grandfather is the past, the old America of slavery and civil war, of oppression and racism and poverty, while the boy, caught in the warm glow of the fire's light, is the new America of renewed opportunities, advancement, education, and new beginnings. It's also important that the instrument that leads the boy towards enlightenment is the banjo, an instrument highly significant to African-American slave culture, the music of the American South. The banjo evolved from the gourd instruments of Africa and the West Indies and became integral to slave music throughout the 18th and 19th centuries. By Tanner's time, it was a mainstay of minstrel shows, in which it was the custom to portray African-Americans as boisterous, jaunty, buffoonish, and dim-witted. This portrayal fed into the preconceived notion of white racial superiority, that African-Americans, even if they were no longer slaves, would still be infantile and incapable of self-determined action or remarkable achievements. The shows depicted African-Americans as having an innate musicality, which acknowledged their talent but undermined their intelligence. For Tanner, painting this image of generational torch passing was a way of debunking the entrenched derogatory stereotypes of African-Americans propagated by minstrel shows. In Tanner's paintings, we see the grandfather and the boy as intelligent, noble, graceful people engaged in an intimate act of sharing of a creative knowledge. Their lesson became emblematic of the larger African-American journey of the late 19th century and early 20th century, from emancipation and reconstruction, from the terrors and injustices of Jim Crow laws, and from the exodus of the Great Migration, and the formant and dynamism of the Harlem Renaissance. After painting the banjo lesson, as well as the Thankful Poor, Tanner moved back to Paris, where he would remain for the remainder of his life. Tanner felt that France was less encumbered with baggage of racial prejudice towards people of color than the U.S. In America, I'm Henry Tanner, Negro artist. But in France, I'm Monsieur Tanner, l'artiste américain. This desire to be recognized by the quality of his talent would inspire him to paint prolifically throughout his life, traveling through the Middle East and North Africa in search of authentic imagery for biblical paintings that would become the hallmark of his later career. But it is the banjo lesson that has become the iconic painting of his entire career. Its economy of scale, its emotional delicacy, its nuanced orchestration of light and shadow and symbolism situates it in a resonant space in American art history. My name is Mark DeWitt, and this is today's Black History Moment.
You'll never know. Better get to learning.
That was Rhiannon Giddens singing Better Get Your Learnin' off of one of her latest albums, Songs of Our Native Daughters. The song was originally a minstrel song about getting up in the morning or something that she rewrote to express the struggle to get an education for newly freed slaves in the 19th century. Before that, Mark DeWitt of Sinclair College presented a mini art history lesson on the Banjo Lesson, a famous 19th century painting by then world-renowned African-American artist Henry Ossawa Tanner. To end the show, we're going to hear more banjo music and history from Rhiannon Giddens, but now we're going to turn to bookmole Larry Bolden, who's reviewing Kylie Reed's debut novel, Such a Fun Age. Larry?
Good morning. In a wonderfully perceptive and often humorous debut novel, Such a Fun Age, Kylie Reed takes on issues of race and class in a delightfully light-handed way. It is the story of two women, a white woman, Alex Chamberlain, who writes a kind of inspirational blog urging women to take power in the workplace, and a 25-year-old black woman, Amira, who babysits Alex's wonderfully precocious 3-year-old daughter, Briar, so that Alex can work from home. Amira and her three closest friends, Zara, Josepha, and Shani, are all recent college graduates. They often go out drinking and dancing together, and the novel opens with the four women at a birthday party for Shani. Due to an egging at the Chamberlain house, which includes a rock being thrown through a doorway window, Alex calls Amira, begging her to come take Briar away from the house for an hour or so, since the police have been called, and Alex and her husband Peter do not want young Briar to be exposed to the hubbub of flashing lights and police in the home. Amira agrees, though explaining that she's dressed for the party and does not look much like a babysitter. No problem, insists Alex, and promises to send a cab and to pay her double for the inconvenience. Since this opening scene is pivotal to the rest of the novel, I will recount a bit more without giving much of the storyline away. Amira takes Briar to a very upscale little convenience store nearby to keep her entertained during the police visit. Zara has accompanied Briar and Amira to the store, and they end up dancing down one of the aisles with Briar leading the way. An overzealous security guard decides that since Amira is obviously not the mother of the child, he needs to intervene. A very tall young white man begins to use his phone to capture video of the encounter and to offer up advice to Amira. Quoting from the novel, "Hey, hey, hey," the man behind the cell phone tried to get Amira's attention. "Even if they ask, you don't have to show your ID. It's Pennsylvania state law." Amira said, "I know my rights, dude." "Sir," the security guard stood and turned, "you do not have the right to interfere with a crime." Hold up, a crime? What crime is being committed right now? I'm working, I'm making money right now, and I bet I'm making more than you." "Okay, ma'am," the security guard widened his stance to match hers. "You're being held in question because of the safety of a child is at risk." Close quote. Amira manages to call the Chamberlain's home, and within minutes, the husband, Peter, shows up. The security guard completely changes his demeanor, and the situation de-escalates. The young man who tried to intervene, Kelly, turns out to be a central character in the rest of the novel. Much of the early parts of the novel are taken up with conversations between Amira and her best friends, and Alex and her best friends. All of the friends are various shades of color, and the repartee between the women is often very funny and enlightening about working women in New York and Philadelphia and the struggles with childcare. Although resistant at first, Amira begins to date Kelly. They trade stories about their lives and soon realize how compatible they are. The third star of this book is Briar, or simply B, and her many interactions with Amira, whom she calls Mira. Alex, who loves the relationship between her daughter and Amira, begins to try to make Amira a part of the family and seems to genuinely love her. Alex's parents had come into a lot of money at some point in Alex's childhood and used it in showy ways to buy extravagant homes and cars. As it happens, Alex and Kelly had a tumultuous relationship in high school, and that relationship causes near disastrous consequences for Amira and Kelly, as well as Alex. Amira learns that not only does Kelly have a lot of black friends, but that he seems to date only light-skinned black women. The many conversations between the women reveal so much about race and class issues, But author Reed is, I think, extremely skillful in stepping back as a narrator and allowing the characters themselves to bring out the issues. Even when the novel turns very serious in the end, Reed refuses to enter in as an omniscient narrator or even to provide commentary on the actions that take place. Given this is Black History Month, I had initially intended to talk about Zora Neale Hurston, Alice Walker, Toni Morrison, and Toni Cade Bambara, all of whom I've reviewed in the past years, but there's something so fresh and crisp about Reed's writing and such a here-and-now look at questions of race and class that I felt I must review her novel. Hard to believe it is a debut novel, but then she's been writing for a long time and is published in many magazines. The combination of humor and wisdom in this book makes it one that I hope will lead to being widely read. I've been talking about Kylie Reed's 2019 novel, Such a Fun Age. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Oh, thanks, Larry. I'm going to put that on hold at the Multnomah County Library, where I just checked, and you can get it in book, ebook, and downloadable audiobook formats, multcolib.org. Well, to wrap up today's show, we're going to hear a final few selections of music and documentaries I've pieced together about the Afro-Atlantic origins of the banjo. The first is from David Holt's PBS show, David Holt's State of Music, while the other is from a promotional audio clip for a documentary called A Great American Tapestry. Both of them feature Rhiannon Giddens' voice and banjo playing. I hope you enjoy.
What gives Southern music its distinctive sound is the blending of music from the British Isles with the music of Africa. Now, that began to evolve in the 1800s in the South and has affected American music ever since. Black string bands featuring banjo and fiddle have been playing in the South since before the Civil War. The Thompson Brothers from Mebane, North Carolina, carried on that tradition into the 21st century. Luckily for us, a group of young black musicians was inspired by the Thompsons and started the Carolina Chocolate Drops. The group has been wildly successful due in large part to the talents of Rhiannon Giddens as a singer, banjo player, and fiddler. Today, I'm meeting Rhiannon here at the historic Horn Creek Farm in Pinnacle, North Carolina. You know, I think most people think of the banjo as the quintessential American instrument, but tell us about it coming from Africa.
Well, there's a lot of string instruments, lute instruments in West Africa. And so when Africans came over to the Americas, they either brought the instruments or the memory of the instruments with them. And in the Caribbean in particular, that was the first sort of meshing of Anglo and Celtic and African sort of cultures, music, and dance. And so the instrument that sort of came out of that syncretization, we now call the banjo, and it traveled up to North America with the slaves and became, you know, a well-known, you know, plantation instrument. So first, say, 100 years of its existence in the Americas, it was known as a black instrument, and that's how people considered it.
And then how did it get into the white community?
Well, in the 1840s and 50s, some entertainers started to look at the banjo and go, that's pretty cool. And one in particular, Joel Sweeney. We know as maybe he wasn't the first white man ever, but he was the first that we know of to pick it up. He made some changes to it, you know, whereas instruments before would have been more handmade, sort of gourd type instruments. He made some changes to it, and also his colleagues, you know, one thing being the wooden rim. And so they started to take the banjo out, performing with it all over the country. They went to the UK, they went to Australia, they went to Europe, and
spread it around the
world. Yeah, they did. It was the first really American cultural export, like 100 years before rock and roll. And one of the reasons why we don't talk about this is because they were doing it in blackface as part of the minstrel show. And that's, you know, for various reasons, that's a really hard thing for us to talk about. It's a lot of negativity that goes along with that. But you also have to look at the fact that it was the most popular form of entertainment in America for over 50 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's at the root of our culture, music, dance.
It's just what started Broadway.
It started everything, you know, syncopation.
There really was not much syncopation in American music then. Give us a little example of something, and I'll play the bones.
Yeah, so this was originally published in 1855, the very first banjo tutor called the Briggs Banjo Instructor. So this is a little piece from that.
Yeah, that's That's great. The other thing that's, I think, interesting about the minstrel shows is that's actually how black performers started getting into show business.
Yeah, I mean, after emancipation, that was the only way that they could be entertainers, was to actually blacken up, to put on blackface. Sometimes the blackface was lighter than their actual skin tone, mm-hmm. you know, but that was the only way that they could get into the entertainment industry. And that was a really great industry for a lot of African Americans, because of just the, if you had ability, you could get into it. You know, as long as you blackened up, you could do it instead of so many of the other things that were sort of closed to them. You know, so that was definitely a way to make a living.
And when white people actually saw black people performing and saw how talented they were, that they just wanted to see more.
Yeah, I mean, that was where I think the blackface minstrel show started to kind of go downhill, is that people started, you can see it in the press of the time, people started going, why are there white folks being in blackface when there's actually these black performers doing, you know, but then, you know, in the black community, the blackface minstrel show sort of, you know, it was subverted, and some of the comedy that comes out of that. I mean, when that's your only outlet, you know, and it's such a sort of negative thing, you have to sort of turn it to, you know, you have to turn it, or otherwise you can't survive, you know. So some of black humor and some of the oldest, you know, things in black entertainment come out of that sort of subversion of the minstrel show. So I mean, it's extremely important to talk about. George Buck is dead, last word he said, don't you put no shortening in my bread. George Buck is dead, last word he said, don't you put no shortening in my bread. George Buck is dead, last word he said, don't you let your woman have her way. If she has her way, she will go and stay all day. Don't let your woman have her way. Well, we know what we're doing. So interesting, and is so hidden in American culture. You know, you don't have the banjo until you have a lot of people from different parts of, you know, primarily West Africa, coming over, not under their own volition, being brought over to North America, particularly to the Caribbean, which is where, you know, people who were going to be sold into slavery were seasoned, you know, especially if they were going to end up going up to North America. So much of what becomes African American music and dance is formed, you know, in the Caribbean, in Congo Square, in New Orleans, where all of these different cultures didn't speak the same language, weren't playing the same instruments, but were playing in a sort of family of instruments, of these lute type instruments, you know, either the memory brought over or the instruments themselves brought over. And then, you know, the syncretization of all of that, you know, forming what becomes known as the banjo, the banjar, the banjur, whatever, banza, in the Caribbean, and then being brought with people up to the southern United States, or actually just the United States in general, you know, because people forget that there were enslaved people all over, you know, from, you know, I think it was like the first European settler stepped foot on, you know, in North America, and like 20 years later is the first African-American, you know what I mean? It's like very, very intertwined all over the place, you know, and that's really important to remember, because the image of you know, slavery in the Deep South leaves out the Tidewater region, the Mid-Atlantic, and all of those folks that were forming these cultures, these enslaved cultures that then were marched down to the pens in Louisiana and then over to Texas and to Alabama and Mississippi, you know. So it's a very much a wide cultural thing, you know. So you have African Americans with this native instrument, you know, this truly American instrument, the banjo, and it's a plantation instrument for the first 100 years of its existence, and no white person plays it. Like, people know it. That's a plantation instrument, and you have this, and you also have black musicians being trained to play for white dances, you know. So you have these dance masters, you know, coming in, but then, you know, black musicians pretty quickly become very prized, and so they're going back to the quarters and they're playing the banjo and they're doing all this, you know, their music and dance, and then they're going to play for these European dances and they're playing fiddle, and, you know, there's all of these primary sources about, you know, that Dirk could play a Strathspey, you know. It's like they're learning Scottish tunes and English tunes and all of the, whoever owns the plantation, you know. And then, of course, that's going to come back and it's going to mix. And, you know, the first people to play fiddle with a banjo would be African Americans. I mean, that's just obvious, you know. It's like they've got the banjo. So, and they've had the fiddle for hundreds of years. They have these, you know, runaway slave posters saying, you know, plays the fiddle, plays the fiddle, plays the fiddle. It's like highly prized. So you have all that coming into being. And then you have this form, this sort of string band form. Of course, there's interactions between, you know, whites and blacks, particularly poor whites and blacks, because they're the ones, you know, interacting. Like, you know, the aristocracy is not interested in this, you know. So you've got all this stuff, and you start getting the first white people playing the banjo, these traveling entertainers. Like, those are the ones we know about. I mean, who's to say that there wasn't some, you know, some white people, like, who weren't entertainers, like, you know, who were, you know what I mean? Like, who's to say that? But that's what we know. You know, is these blackface entertainers start playing the banjo. They make some changes to it, but, you know, in form, it's like the stuff they do it doesn't change the basic form of the banjo. There's no adding the fifth string. I mean, it was already there, and, you know, all of these sorts of things. And then so blackface entertainers start taking the banjo, and people go nuts. They're like, what is this thing? This is amazing, you know. And it becomes this cultural explosion. Like, they travel to Europe and Australia and South Africa, and it's the whole world's first encounter with American music, even done through white people playing in blackface.
Rhiannon Giddens, crossover musician and the final founding member of the Chocolate Drops team, wraps up things for us right here.
It's important to remember everything that goes into the tapestry of, you know, American music, whether it's Appalachian music or, you know, Piedmont music or whatever. It's important to remember all of the strands, because that's the truth. And the truth is always much more interesting than the fiction that is being fed to us, you know? And the truth is what informs who we are and explains why we do what we do. The truth does that. Illusions don't do that. Illusions obfuscate. You know, they're feeding. If there's an illusion that's being sold, it's because somebody is selling it. And why are they selling it? You know what I mean? Anything that goes into keeping us apart, anything that goes into us not understanding each other, is going into the ruling class and their desire to keep us all separated so they can continue making money and having all the power. That's it. I mean, even this kind of, you know, people might think, oh, this is a very specific, it's all part of the game, you know? So, because music is supposed to be able to bring us together. And that's what it has done over and over and over again. It's like, you have nothing else in common, but you can meet musically. People, you know, are making music together, even if they're not, their daughters aren't talking, even if they, you know, can't speak in public, they can make music, you know? And anything that's going to take that away, I think, should be looked at in a very shady manner, you know, because that's the experiment that is America. That is why it succeeded, is because of all of those colors, not just the one, but all of them.
Everybody talking about the sweet nowadays. I got the one with the sweetest ways.
When we lose our history, we lose who we are, because everything that's gone up into this moment has made our culture the way it is. So if we don't understand that, A, we're going to keep making the same stupid mistakes, and B, we have lost the core of what it means to be American. You know, and you see it happening now. People forcing these narratives down these undereducated people's throats, and I include myself in that. I mean, I didn't know about the banjo until I was an adult. I'm always wary. It's knowledge is power, and knowing that we're more alike than different is powerful, and that's why they don't want us to know that. Not admitting that America is the sum of all of its parts, you know, all of the different cultures that came in and did this thing. There's a reason why the world loves American music, is because everybody sees a piece of themselves in it.
George Buck's dead, last word said, don't you put no shortening in my bread. Don't you put no shortening in my bread, now, now. Don't put no shortening in my bread.
Well, that's it for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been your host, Joe Clement. Patricia Kohlberg has been our engineer. Tammy Hepteus is our AM Public News Director. Thanks to our guest today, to Bill Resnick, who reached out to Sharon Grant to produce that amazing piece, reading from the essay, Our Nation's Founding Ideals Weren't True, but Black Americans Have Fought to Make Them True. You can listen to more from that essay that Sharon and Bill will be sharing next week on The Old Mole. Thanks to Larry Bolden for his review of Kylie Reed's debut novel, Such a Fun Age. And thank you to Rhiannon Giddens and to all of the people who have brought the banjo to where it is today. It is an amazing gem of an instrument. It has laid the foundation for a whole culture, and it has been a grounding point for resistance movements for hundreds of years. You can listen to The Old Mole on KBOO's website, kboo.fm/oldmole. Just go there in a couple days and you'll find the whole show and individual segments. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter by just looking for The Old Mole Variety Hour, and you can email us to give us questions, comments, or if you'd like to do stuff with us and be on the show and learn how to make radio. Tune in next week for more news, reviews, and interviews from the Old Mole's underground radical feminist socialist analysis.